I wanted to speak a bit about some problems in schooling, some problems in education. Who was at Sandton last Tuesday night? Last Tuesday night in Sandton, I think you could probably get a recording, we discussed the question of education in general, values and methodology that has to be applied in the home, and some of the problems of schools. I'd like to start with some of the issues. First of all, how many teachers here? So, tread our way cautiously. We want to deal with some of the problems that may arise in schools that cause children generally to be... The problem is, let's be honest about it, the problem is that there are many children who are not getting out of the school system what they should be getting out of it. On the contrary, they end up damaged. Many children, especially young ones, they end up damaged by the school system, they end up losing confidence, they end up losing all sense of self-worth when they go off to... As Mrs. Linda Dermick puts it, when they go off to nursery school, they're wonderful, young, confident, outgoing children, right, Mrs. Dermick? And then what happens is a little bit later, they come out unconfident, battered children who feel that they're not worth anything, that they don't get prizes, they're just not, and they learn how to not even do what's possible, where a Jew should learn how to do the impossible. What a Jewish child needs to learn is how even the impossible is not out of limits, that he can do, she can do the impossible. And what they do at school, often they teach kids that even what should be possible, you won't be able to do. I mean, the sadness is that a lady like Mrs. Dermick actually has to work with children just to restore, individual children, just to restore the self-confidence that they often lose at school with her AIM program, which I think is fantastic. If you happen to have a problem that you can't get the school right, then I think you unfortunately have to speak to her. The point is, however, that there are certain problems. Now, the way to go about this is not to have a discussion here where we just criticize people who run schools and teachers who may be doing their best. There's no question that the school is limited. There is a certain limitation in the format of having a lot of children together. There's a massive limitation in having the concept of a syllabus where all the kids have to more or less get through the same work in the first place. I'm not saying there aren't limitations within the system. Doesn't mean maybe we shouldn't consider changing the system, and that we can't maybe work more sensitively within the system, but the point is that there are limitations within the system, and we're not here, it's not my intention to blame individuals that they are not doing a good enough job. That's not the point. The point is to put in some Torah ideas about how education, especially of little children, should be done in such a way that we can bring up children who are not only going to cope with life, but are going to have some possible option of achieving greatness. Maybe somebody could switch that off for me, is that possible? Could you switch it to north, please? Is that what's making the noise? No. Just have to switch the dial to zero. There's no dial? So, Dermick, you can come to my course on problem solving and... Okay, thanks. Really what we need to understand is a few basic principles of Torah education in the first place, which, as I said, we went through in more detail before. Let me try just to... we only have a very short time today. Let's try and just make a few basic points that are necessary with special reference to the school system, but that you can apply in general in all relationships, and certainly in child raising in a home environment. If you wish to study this subject in more detail, then you'd have to refer to the cassettes where we discussed parent and child. And this evening in Sandton, we are due to discuss the question of helping a child find what is his specific personality. What we're discussing this morning is trying to help children feel that they can be confident, that they can be successful. But then there's another step, which is helping a child and helping you and an adult and your husband, whatever it is, discover what it is that makes you unique so that you can feel that you're achieving what only you can achieve in the world, which is exactly what the Torah understands, that you have a chalik in Torah means that only you can do this particular job. That's a subject we can't go into now, but of course that's where the subject actually begins in terms of working out what it is that I have to do as opposed to the next person. Of course I have to be decent and I have to be a mensch like the next person, but what is it that I have a special function that makes me unique in the world that the next person doesn't have to do? That invitation we'll discuss this evening in terms of discovering what your particular potentials are. I'll try and work that out in detail. But for the basics, what we need to know is this. First of all, we need to know the following thing. Everything that a child has to do, everything that a person has to do in the world, they need two things. They need, first of all, the kalim, that means they need the tools. They need the tools to be able to do the job that they have to do. They can't do the job without the tools. Without those elements in your personality that you need to do the job, we can't start talking about the job, because the person won't be able to do his function if he hasn't yet developed the tools that he needs. And secondly, he needs to know what the job is. That's what we have to work out, okay? We need to work out in basic terms now, what is it? What are the tools that a child needs? How do you build that structure in the personality that the child now has a valid and functioning structure, where his wires aren't crossed, where he's not confused, where he has a deep sense of his own potential and his own mechanisms of how he can tackle any job? And secondly, we need to know what exactly is the job that he should be tackling. Now, how do we stimulate and inspire a child? It's all up to you and your inspiration. I mean, people don't realize that the inspiration you give a child in the early years, that lasts, forms an impression on the child that even if they're not conscious of later. How do you form a child for marriage, for example? How do you teach a young girl what to look for in marriage? Now, we mentioned this, I think, last week. When she's 5 years old or 6 years old, and you go out someplace, you point out to her how helpful a young man is who's helping his mother, let's say. Right? Or how gentle and kindly a certain... So then the little girl will grow up with the concept that her mother idealizes and values a man who's sensitive and gentle and kindly and helps. As I said last week, that if the mother has posters of gorillas, you know, that's how she adorns the rooms of the walls of her bedroom, with gorillas who can pick up 500 pounds in each hand, you know, then the child's not going to grow up with a sensitivity about a gentle and kindly man. But that's an idea you have to put in when you're young. So you have to put into the child when they're very young the whole the idealism of being able to do things and being able to do what's greater than, larger than life. No question about it. So first of all, what are the tools? Before we get to the job, what are the tools for the job? So the tools for the job, the most important thing that there could be, the most important thing that there could be for a small child is their own sense, their own self-worth, their self-esteem. They have to feel that they are capable. They have to feel that they are special, that they are wonderful, that they are capable. You don't have to worry that a child will be overconfident. They'll get knocked off out of them. You'll be lucky if they end up a little older with any confidence at all anyway, even if they start off with a childish overconfidence. But if a child starts off depressed and unconfident when they're small, they've got almost no hope later. When are they ever going to discover that they are capable? Don't have to worry about a little child. Little children naturally feel that they're larger than life, they can take on the whole world, that they are going to be absolutely anything. They don't have any contradictions. My little son's still trying to decide whether he wants to be a Talmud Chacham or a rubbish man. You know, he thinks he's actually probably going to be both. He doesn't see the problem. You know, there's no any concept of limitations or preconceptions. They've got powers that are greater than reality anyway. You don't want to stifle that. You want to bring up that you want a child to have a very rich sense of his own. If in the early years you fracture that sense of self-worth, that image, and I mean very early years. I'll never forget when my first child was born, I took her to a Hasidic Rebbe. The child was 3 months old. 3 months old! And I took her to a certain Rebbe for a brocha, very idealistic, and I asked him if she'd give this child a brocha that she should be an outstanding child, very unusual. He looked at me and said, "It's much too late." He said, "I give her a bracha, she should be wholesome and normal." You hear that? Too late already. I mean, for the pregnancy, during the pregnancy, I don't know, child's born, I don't know, but during my pregnancy, I don't know. But anyway, he's probably looking at me, said it was too late. Anyway, the point is that it has to start early, and that's what a child needs, a tremendous sense of self-confidence, self-esteem. And that's what schools damage. What schools damage, unfortunately, what the schooling system does is, in the pre-grade and early years, the schools are wonderful. I haven't yet come across a school that has a problem there. Because they don't put any competitive, demanding layers on top of the child. The child's able to express their own creativity, and it's all rewarded, so the child thrives. Not always. Maybe there's some schools that don't, I don't know. But in the very early years, usually, you get teachers who are sensitive, who love little children. Usually, they love to bring out the children's creativity. The children love to bring out their own creativity. I'm not talking about problem children, I'm talking about normal children, usually. But when they get to the danger age in our system is an age where they're in the primary school bracket. What happens then is, you see, the later age, maybe high school, you might differ with me, but later in high school and later in life, I don't personally think there's a problem if there's competitiveness and differential awarding of prizes and grades and so forth. I don't think it should be done. But I'm not sure that it's a harmful thing, because life is competitive and they will come up against competition. They will discover that life isn't fair. And I'm not sure that it's a bad thing that they... But the point is that you dare not do that during their formative years when their personality is being formed. If they have to cope with competition later when they have an identity as a human being. You know, in psychiatry, it's been well shown, I remember medical school seeing this, in psychiatry it's been well shown that when a trauma happens to a child, it's critical at what age that trauma happens. If a trauma happens to a child like, well, the loss of a parent, for example, if the child's over 15, that's what they show in psychiatric studies, perhaps you can argue with age, but over that sort of age group, the child doesn't take it as a personal threat. The child takes it as something that is sad and negative and problematic, but it doesn't threaten their own existence. Whereas if the child's very small and a thing like that happens, the child feels that contrast love. They feel that the person they trusted has let them down. They have a deep and abiding sense of impending doom and of mistrust, and it can be like, not necessarily, but it can be. Depends at which age. And therefore, if a child's old enough to handle a problem, like the fact that they don't do as well as the next child in school, so they have to learn how to handle that maturely. I don't think that's a problem. But if you do it at an age where a child can't handle it maturely, where they don't understand, they end up thinking that they're a failure, you can't get that out of them, that is a very cruel and criminal thing to do. Now, what are some of the ways to approach this problem? The Torah way of approaching this system, and I'll try and show you that it's not by being easy on children, by no means. Discipline should be extreme. There's no question about it. A child needs, as I'll try and show you, tremendous outpouring of love and a tremendously strong structure of discipline. There's no question about it. One of the major problems with our society is the lack of discipline that children get. There's no question. No one's saying they don't need discipline or structure. And no one's saying they don't need demands made out of them. A child needs the ultimate demands to be made out of him. But the point is not in comparison to anybody else. The child needs to have demands made on him to achieve his or her fantastic potential. Unbelievable, but you have to open vistas for the child that didn't even know existed. But what's it got to do with comparing to the next child? The next child's got different abilities and a whole different challenge in life. And by comparing this child to the next child, you break down there. Our schools work in such a way. Unfortunately, Torah schools also do this. I'm not laying blame here. But because they have a secular syllabus also, and not all teachers are trained and tuned to this particular idea, it's not always better in a Torah school. A real Torah school where there's only Torah material, in the real yeshiva world, there's fierce competition, no question about it. It's always been that way, and extreme demands. But the point is, no one's ever held accountable for anybody else's standard. I chose to go to yeshiva. I chose, where there are marks given, tests and marks, and you had an oral examination every month of the Rosh Yeshiva and a written test. I chose to go because I didn't feel motivated enough to learn to my full abilities if I wasn't tested. That's how, in the old days, yeshiva was, the person was purely self-motivated. I felt that I wasn't able, so I went to a place like that. But no one else ever saw my marks. No one, he never made any bones about my inadequacy. When I sat with him for an oral test, he didn't miss a single point. You can't fool him. You know, at medical school, you can fool him sometimes, that you know a bit more than you actually do. They're so tired of examining students anyway, they're only too happy for you to talk about something that you know about. But in the Gemara, you can't fool anybody. You can't fool a Rosh Yeshiva that you know the Gemara. You either know it or you don't. And if I hadn't been working hard enough, he never made it easy, by no means. The Musa that I got in Yeshiva, there's no question that demands were extreme. I mean, there's a person who used to sit next to me in Yeshiva. Every now and then he'd turn around to me, one of the best in the Yeshiva, young man who achieved amazing things. He sometimes used, when he saw I was going a little slow, he didn't go easy on me. He used to turn to me and say, "You think because you've given up being a doctor and you're coming and you're sitting in your ship, you think you're doing Hashem a favor?" He used to say to me, "You think you're doing Hashem a favor? Why aren't you doing 20 times as much as you are?" I mean, he used to slam me and crush me. I mean, yes? No one's saying you don't make demands and tell people the way it is. But the point is that when I went for that test, and my Rosh Yeshiva would sit and tell me what was wrong with me, and he'd hand me a mark, which was embarrassing. But it was folded over, and I got it privately, in private with him, and no one ever saw it. No one ever asked to see my mark. Why is it relevant to me, with my abilities and my problems and my handicaps and my talents, to compare myself against the next child? You take a little child of 5 or 6 or 7, and this child has certain talents and certain disadvantages. Now, the child next to him is much more talented and does half the amount of work. And what happens? You come to a prize giving the little child next door. He's given a prize for being the best in the class. The child hardly worked at all. This child worked like anything. And the child thinks he's a failure. Have you ever seen the faces of children at a prize giving? Have you ever seen anything more cruel than a primary school prize giving? You shouldn't let your child go to that. There's no question. And if you do, buy your child a prize. Bribe the teacher. Bribe the teacher to give your child a prize. Threaten the teacher. That makes no difference. But the point is, a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, they go and they, the child next to him, everybody else gets a prize for being the best at this and the best at that, and your child, this child gets it. The child doesn't have the maturity to understand, yes, well, he's also got qualities, you know, and he's also got things that Hashem loves about him. You can say that, you know, but the child sees right through it. The child thinks that he's a failure. Either everybody gets a prize or nobody. What's wrong with giving them all a prize? What's wrong with giving them all a, you know? There are some teachers who never give an A. Okay, I know an excellent teacher, a teacher that I think is fantastic, I'm ready to say it, who's inspired my children probably more than anybody, but the teacher never gives an A. Why? She wants the children to see that you have to really strive and so forth and so on. It's a lovely idea, but it has problems. Why? Because the other teachers give A's. So the child's standard, yes, is that you can achieve A's, and in this class, the child feels that they're not yet. A child needs to be shown that they can achieve perfection. When you're older, you have the maturity to know that you can never really achieve perfection. But you have to have your sight set on, yes, achieving what's called shleimus and perfection. If a child started from the earliest ages with the idea that there's no such thing as getting an A, the child reads that, the child doesn't see that. A child needs to be given A's, and if they don't deserve it, to see that they, to build their confidence, is much more important. So the principle, that the byword is, that there has to be severe competition against yourself. There's no question about it. And absolute demands and inspiration on yourself. But nothing to do with somebody else. I know a little girl who won't go to school, who cried before going to school because the teacher calls out the marks. When the teacher hands back the tests, she calls out the marks. So this child is terribly embarrassed because she does fine. She does absolutely fine. She does above average. But other children do better, and they snigger, and they make her feel bad when the marks are called out. And even if the teacher doesn't call out the marks, they come around asking, because, and she feels embarrassed. Either way, she doesn't show them her mark. She's embarrassed because they think she did worse. And she shows them her mark, and it's not as good. Children are very vulnerable. They're very sensitive to it. I know a little girl who won't go to school because the sports teacher is insensitive. What happens? The sports teacher takes them out to the field. That's a sports teacher. Probably the teacher hasn't been trained in psychology and sensitivity and where children are vulnerable. So the teacher chooses two children who are the best in sport and says, okay, you each choose a team. You choose a team, you choose a team. So the child, they choose a team, and this child's never chosen because she's a liability to the team. Any team with that child on, for sure, there's no question he's going to lose. Yeah, there's no question about it. So what happens? So the children will, and finally when this child's left, the one team has to take her. So they say, oh, we've got her now, we're going to lose, you know. So the child feels like an absolute and utter disaster. She won't go to school. The teacher shouldn't do that. The teacher should choose the teams. And if any child utters half a syllable of protest, the teacher should sit them down on the sports field and explain to them the importance of what it means to boost a human character and what it means to say something negative. What's the difference if they win or lose the race or if they run the race that day? So what do? You send a child to school to gain what exactly? Some arithmetic and Afrikaans and so forth, and you bring home a smashed child that day. That child just learned that you know, that she's just incapable. The child doesn't see it in terms of, well, she's beautiful and lovely and got a lovely personality. The child thinks that a total failure because no one in the class wants it because they lose it. My Rosh Hashiva told me that once, in terms of protecting the particular privacy of a child's own situation, he told me once when he went to yeshiva, 17 years old, he went from Lakewood to Mir Yeshiva in Jerusalem, and he was very idealistic, and he said his first kabura. He was in a group of boys who were very good, some of the senior boys in the yeshiva, and he had to make his first presentation. So they sat in a room, and he presented the first time he ever had to present his ideas in the Gemara. He says, "You told me it was so bad that they laughed. They laughed at him. The boy, he couldn't help laughing. It's so silly because so badly prepared. I can't imagine him saying anything that wasn't good. But he said it wasn't good, and they actually involuntarily laughed at him. Okay? And they told him exactly what was wrong with it or not. Then he said like this. As they left the room, listen to this, amazing thing. As they left the room, he was about to leave, and one of the older boys was leaving the room, and as he walked out into the passage, another boy in yeshiva who hadn't been present, one of the juniors, walked past, and he wanted to know how this new boy had done. So he said to the senior boy, how did he do? How did he say? And he heard the older boy saying, very good. You hear that? In the room, in the privacy of the thing, they laughed at him. But for presentation to the outside, what's it your business? What's it your business what his failings are? It's got absolutely nothing to do with you. Do you follow that? And he said, fine, very good. He said, very well. You hear that? And that's what you want. You want a child to come home doing that? I mean, that's worth, you know what that's worth? I mean, my sister was in the Bagleston clinic the other day. A child from one of the Torah schools, a child from one of the religious schools in Johannesburg, came in with three broken fingers. What happened? It was a Sunday, and the child was climbing the teacher for extra lessons. The door was locked. So the teacher told him to climb through the window of the classroom. And the child climbed up, and as he climbed through the window and hanging on the other side, before he could dropped down. Another child on the outside thought he was already gone and smashed the window on his fingers and broke three fingers, okay? It was an accident. The child didn't realize he was there. So they came for x-rays. The child was in intense pain. And he came for his thing. So my sister jokingly said to the mother, I hope you'll send the bull to the mother of the child who broke his fingers. In a joke. So the mother said, he won't tell me who it is. He said it was an accident and it's got nothing to do with me. He won't tell me who the child is. Isn't that marvelous? Imagine that. And it's nothing negative. It was an accident. Do you know what that's worth? Do you know how much Afrikaans spelling that's worth? You know? If your child can do arithmetic and spell in Afrikaans, you know, I hate to say it, but it's Zulu, whatever it is they're going to learn these days. It's almost irrelevant. They're not going to make a successful marriage because they can spell in Afrikaans. That's irrelevant. I mean, a child has to know that whatever they do, they must do well. If they're doing academics, they must do their best. There's no question that it's unhealthy for a child not to learn to do their best. But it's irrelevant in terms of life skills. So where exactly are you teaching this? Where exactly are you teaching it? When my wife taught first at a Torah school, I remember, I'll never forget, she came home from a six-year-old classroom the first day, and she told me she was amazed. Why? What amazed her? She saw on the wall of the classroom star charts. The kids got, you know, a gold star for doing well at the arithmetic, doing well. So she told me she saw charts on the wall, gold stars for spelling, gold stars for arithmetic, and gold stars for medicine. What are medicine? If a child shared his lunch with a child who didn't have, he got a gold star. Now, if you don't do that, you know what you're teaching the child? You're teaching the child that spelling in Afrikaans is important and arithmetic is Afrikaans, but we don't care if another child stars. We don't care if you're sympathetic, if you share. That's what you're teaching a child. Because the children understand, they have a very mercenary approach to things. They understand that where you give marks and where you show reward and where you, yeah, the way our reports are, the reports grade them exactly to the percent, 67.5% for spelling in Afrikaans. But good behavior is like a sort of general sort of comment on the side, you know, a pleasant child. That's not the way, when the parent opens the report, that's not the way you must do it. You open the report, you must say to the child, when the child comes home with a test, the parents looks at it with sort of a glum face and they say, what everybody else get? That's what the parent says. What did so-and-so get? What did so-and-so get? You just smashed your child. You don't do that. When the child comes home with a report, you say, it says here that you're a kindly, gentle, courteous, beautiful child. That's fantastic. And then, by the way, you sort of look at the mark. And you don't compare to it. It's irrelevant. Knowing the marks is not totally irrelevant, because it's important to know what is the average that can be expected from that age. There's no question you need certain guidelines. The teacher needs to know. There's no question, and maybe parents need to know certain guidelines about what's normal at that age. You need to know if your child is coping in terms of an average, so there's no question about that. But that's got nothing to do with making the child feel that they're in competition with somebody else who's got a different role in life, a different talent, different ability. I mean, this message is so basic. It's embarrassing that we even have to talk about it. But the school system is geared that way. It's geared towards the syllabus. It's geared towards getting the syllabus across. Unfortunately, and often the human side often gets lost. In the Torah system, it's much better usually, not always, because Torah values explicitly are to build a mensch. So anybody teaching Torah subjects must have as the basis of their teaching the fact nobody learns Torah, as I pointed out to you many times before, no one learns Torah for the academic knowledge of Torah. The only reason anybody ever engages in Torah studies is because of what it does to your personality. There's no question about it. If it's not doing the right things to your personality, it's not Torah anyway. There's no question that somebody teaching Torah has at heart the development of the character and sensitivity and personality that they're building. There's no question about it. It has to be there. But even then, unfortunately, sometimes it gets competitive and it's not always done in the correct way. Now, secondly, there's much more to say about it, but I think I've made the point, and I hope I've made the point obvious. Secondly, what a child needs is a love for learning. A love for learning. A child's self-confidence and love for learning are light years ahead of the details of the syllabus. I don't care if my child learns half the syllabus or a tenth of the syllabus. It's irrelevant. The details in the syllabus that they learn that year when they're 7 or 8 are irrelevant. In fact, at any age, it's irrelevant. Even in Torah, I don't care if my child learns half the number of Mishnayos or 10 times the number of Mishnayos, but he should come out loving Mishnayos. If he loves it, he'll learn on his own. You won't be able to stop him if he loves it. But if he learns 10,000 Mishnahs and hates it, as soon as you take the pressure off, he'll stop learning and he'll hate it. You follow it? So what the teacher does is they might get the syllabus across, they might punch it into the child until the child's a zombie full of syllabus, but the child won't love the learning. It doesn't. There are people, unfortunately, now taking their children out of school. I know families are taking their girls out of school in standard 7, standard 8. And they're sending seminaries overseas because the matric system, it's just a completely twisted, from a Torah point of view, Torah personality point of view, is it a twisted sense of values? I remember Cheder in Jerusalem. It was an unbelievable experience, what I saw little boys in Cheder. You couldn't keep them home. If a child was sick, he'd lie to you. He'd give anything to run off to Cheder. Unbelievable. And then I realized how they do it. They do it, and they learn. If you think they learn less syllabus there, if you think that the little, if you think that the children there are behind, they are miles ahead in terms of academic standard and ability and what they hold and what they absorb, but they do it through positivity instead of through saying, I was, of course, it takes adjustment for a South African. The first time I saw it, I longed to come back here for the discipline and the structure. Because the first time I looked in the Khayda, it looked like a zoo. The little boys were climbing over the desks, and they were like, you know, and the teacher was part of it, you know. And when it came to learning, instead of learning in like an academic, organized, disciplined way, they were singing it out. They were singing. And I discovered that's how they do it. You know what they do? They take little boys, I mean, a little bit of modicum of sensitivity of what a child is. You know how they do it? Amazing. I went to look at the Beis Yaakov, the little girls, and I went to look at the boys. Totally different approach. How do they do it? They take little girls of six, they sit them in a desk, neatly with their feet together, how to hold the pencil, and they start forming neat writing and doing, and the girls love it. And the little boys, they don't start them writing for 2 years more. You know why? Because the quickest way to kill a little boy, to make him, you know, just to smash him, is to make him keep his feet together and sit in the desk and hold the pen just like this and make him ready. That's the last thing in the world that you follow. You completely stifle his. You don't do that to a little boy. You take a little boy and you let him sing it out. You let him scream it out. You have a shouting competition. Who can shout the Mishnah the loudest and who can sing it the loudest? That's the way you do it. You give vent to the personality. You might. Boys and girls are different. You have to be tuned to exactly how it is. So what happens is they end up loving it. They run off to Chabad, unbelievable exhilaration, exuberance, and they love it. Can we honestly say that in our school system we're building self-confidence? We're building children who really are inspired by their own uniqueness, by their own personality, what they can do. You watch them year after year, how they sink into themselves. You know, in terms of love learning and love school, if you want to, in case you think I'm exaggerating, you just have to think, what is the classic punishment handed out in school? Detention. Detention. You know what detention means? We're going to punish you by making you stay at school. One second. You're trying to teach them that school's beautiful, right? That we love it. Any opportunity to come to school is fantastic. What's the punishment? You stay an extra hour in school. You know what you're doing? You're admitting to the child that school's a prison, it's a torture, and the best way to torture you is to give you some more of it. Yeah. Detention, you give for a reward. That's what you do. You give a reward. When the child does very well, you give an extra hour of school. That's what it should be. You should get a child to a situation where they would see an extra hour of school as a reward. If you're not doing that, you're failing. Is that correct? Detention. If I ever heard an admission of failure, if I ever heard an admission that a school's a torture and a prison, and not on top of it all, I give you homework. Homework. You know, as it is, the child's forced into this mold and this thing where he's got the tension of comparing himself to everybody else who's more talented, and then he's got to do it at home as well. You know, and let him have a couple hours to be a child. Let him come home and play. Didn't do enough at school. The technical details of what he learned at school is irrelevant anyway. It's how he forms himself as a personality, his own self-confidence and his love of learning. That's what's important. He needs homework too. And if you believe it's a Torah ideal that a child should know, he should learn every day and every night. So a little bit of homework at night to keep him in tune, whatever it is. But he has to come home with a cloud hanging over his head. Yes, that the whole weekend or the whole afternoon is going to matter. Self-confidence and happiness and positivity and love of learning, those are words. Of course, it's much more challenging to be a teacher like that. You have to put up with a less controlled situation, what seems to be a less controlled situation in the class. You have to have much more tuning to the individual, and it's very hard. It's hard to find the time and to find the kochus of nefesh that's needed to work with. So I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not even saying it can be done totally in our system. But certainly there's a lot that we can change the system and a lot that can be done within it. Now let's go as follows. What we discussed up to now are the kalim, the tools that a child needs in order to achieve what it is that they're supposed to be doing. What is it that they're supposed to be doing? Now we spoke about the kalim, the personality, right? What is it that they're supposed to be doing? By the way, let me not forget to say that if you're in a school system where you can't change this, or whether you talk about it and you can't change it, or when other parents aren't tuned this way and whatever it is, then you must do it at home. You must try to be a buffer zone. You must try and function at home in such a way, and the best you can do to teach the child, and yet do it without undermining the teacher. You can't do it by showing it's a very tough line that you have to walk. You have to show the child all the right values, and yet you mustn't do it by showing that the teacher has any. You can't undermine the teacher. It's a very subtle and dangerous and difficult exercise. If you want to know more about it, just speak to Mrs. Dermot. Now, what is it that the child should be learning? What is it? So we've discussed the kalim of the neshama, what they call the kalim of the nefesh. Now, what is it that the child's supposed to be learning with all these kalim? It's not English and Afrikaans and spelling. It's not that. I mean, that's a useful way to spend the time, you know, and it's a useful way to maybe teach a child to exercise their mind and to learn some useful facts about the world. And by the way, biology and geography and natural science and the way the world works, niflos, abore, those are important things for a child to learn. Whether they can spell in whatever language it is exactly, you know, or count their change accurately, when they can do advanced calculus when they're 7, you know, that's much less relevant than how the world works and the wonder of it and the excitement of it. That's what should be coming across. The technicalities are almost irrelevant. What is it that they should be learning? Rasim Khabasman puts it like this, one of the great experts in education, like this: there are two things a child must come out with, okay? You cannot lose sight of this. If the school isn't doing it, this is what you have to give. There are two things a child must have as part of his personality. These are the two things you work on. And if a child has these two things, you have a successful child, successful mensch. And that is what's called consideration and concern. You can write that down and put a red block around it. Consideration and concern. Let's try and understand what these two things mean. Why those two words? Consideration and concern. Listen carefully, you'll see it comes from a deep Kabbalistic root, which is marvelous to know. Consideration means principle of the right hand and the left hand, the self-control discipline element, which comes first, and then the going out and acting with chesed. Are we training children for that? Are our schools training? Are we really training that? Is that what we're giving marks for? Is that what we're rewarding? Are we really training children to be idealistic and motivated? That they see themselves as people who are really going to choose a career and a pathway where they're going to become the world's greatest expert at rigid iron self-control and tremendous outpouring of chesed to help us? Is that, can you say that that's our aim? Do children even get a vague hint someplace ever that that's what they're supposed to be learning? It's terrible. I mean, it's such a cruelty and it's such negative education that we don't even know this, never mind not even put it across to children. What should you inspire a child with? You should tell them stories. The children should be told stories of people who dedicated their lives to consideration or concern or both. Yes, they should be shown examples. You should read them, the kind of books you should read them. You should read them books about somebody becoming a great nuclear physicist, or they learn the literary works of some English writer who wrote beautiful literature and was a disastrous pervert in his private life. That's what they study. That's what English literature, the history of Christianity. English literature is a detailed history of Christian thought, right? Yes, spaced with individuals who write beautifully and with perverts. You read them. You don't read it. You read them books about a Reb Chaim Gell, a man in New York, I think I mentioned, who dedicated his life to helping people. He and his wife made a partnership, and they decided from now on they do nothing else but help other people. And they became extreme at it. And they became inspired and inspiring. When that, you need your child, you want your child. You know what most people, most parents breathe a sigh of relief these days, I can assure you, I've seen it so often. Most parents in the secular world, they give brochas, they bless Hashem, when the child turns up more or less sort of halfway normal and coping. If the child these days marries somebody, who's Jewish, yes, it's mama, it's a mama shasimcha. If their son marries somebody who's a girl these days. Once it used to be, you know, religion, then sort of color. Now that's all, you know. At least he's still in the human zone, you know what I mean? But that's not what Jewish children are to be brought up. Jewish children aren't be brought up to be normal or to cope with sort of more or less. But that's not what a Jewish child is to be. Jewish child is brought up to do the impossible. That's what being Jewish means. We start in impossibility. I mean, as I've so often pointed out, Yitzchak was born from parents who couldn't have children. Right? His father was too old and his mother was infertile. And that's when he was born. His name was called laughter. Jewish life is the laughter of achieving the impossible. That's what it is. Avraham Avinu argued with Hashem because Hashem said he'd have a child and he saw astrologically that he couldn't. Hashem said, well, what's possible got to do with you? You're an impossible human being. You live beyond the realm of the possible. That's what a Jew has to have in his blood. A Jew has to have in his blood the idea that the impossible is possible. Last night we spoke about it in detail. A Jew has to be so inspired that he doesn't accept limitations. There are many sources, Kabbalistic and Musa sources, that say that if you accept any limitations as real, they are real limitations. But if you don't even, you're not even machshiv them, you're not even gurus them, you've got no concept of limitations, you just do. Then all the vistas open up. Hashem is here to let you do what it is that you're supposed to do. The only thing is it hides from you your abilities. That's the test of life. The test of life is that Hashem hides from you your abilities. That's the biggest message. If you knew your abilities, you wouldn't have any ordeal. You just get out there and do it. So he gives you incredible cosmic abilities, and he hides your abilities from you. The biggest challenge is discovering what it is that you could do. Now Joseph brings an amazing thing. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu, unbelievable thing, Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, Moses said to Hashem at one point, I can't do this anymore. You remember that? The Jewish people were heavy load. They were very heavy load. Amazing, powerful personalities. And he was a leader, and it was very heavy. They complained, and they were stressed. They were tremendous. So he said to Hashem, I can't cope. I cannot carry this load alone. I need help. You remember this? So Hashem said, I'll take 70 of the elders, and I'll give them some of your spiritual power. I will take some of the spiritual greatness and power that's on you, and I'll give it to them. And what happened? It says Hashem took off his spiritual greatness, his emanation, and he gave it to them. They all became prophetic in their abilities, and they all helped him. And although he'd given the fire to them, his wasn't lessened at all. And the commentaries say it's like spiritual greatness of this nature is like a flame. When you light one flame from another, the first flame doesn't get smaller. That's a unique quality. When you light one flame from another, it can light endless other flames, but it itself doesn't become any smaller. Moshe Rabbeinu's fire was so great that Hashem took it off from him, gave it to all 70, and his wasn't even affected in the least. You know what the Midrash says about this? Listen to this. Unbelievable. This Midrash you have to teach your children. The Midrash says like this. When Moshe asked Hashem to give him help, the Midrash says like this. There was once a king. Listen, beautiful. There was once a king who had an orchard. And he took an expert, somebody who could look after this orchard, all the trees in the orchard, and he said to the man, this and this is your salary, and I want you to look after this orchard and make it beautiful. So the man started working in the orchard, and after a while he came to the king and he said, I can't do it by myself. I need other people to help me. I need other people. It's a big orchard. It's heavy work. I'm having trouble. I need... So the king said to him as follows, you can have other people, but you pay them. I'm not paying them. It's from your salary, not from mine. I took you because I know you can do this job. I know this job better than you, and I know you can do it. I wanted you. You want others to help you, that's up to you, but don't expect me to pay them. You pay from your salary. What does it mean? That when Moshe Rabbeinu came to Hashem and he said, I can't do this, I need help, Hashem said to him, who knows if you need help or not? Who chose you for this job? I chose you. I know what you can do, and I know what the job is, and I know that you can do it, and I wanted you to do it. You want others. It's from your spiritual greatness that the power will come. I'm not giving it to them. He took it off Moshe and gave it to them. And the message is, listen to this, unbelievable. He took off Moshe Rabbeinu's greatness, and he gave it to 70 other people who became prophets, and Moshe saw that it hadn't even touched him. He learned that his greatness was such that not only did he have the power to do this whole job himself, but when it spilled out to 70 other people who became cosmic in their greatness, you couldn't even discern the difference in him. What do you learn from... Are you with me? What do you learn? You learn that the greatest man who ever lived was unaware of his potential. The greatest man who ever lived, the humblest man who ever lived, the man who was filled with reality, with Torah, nobody ever reached his level of greatness. He was so unaware of his abilities that he really thought he couldn't do the job. You hear that? That means the nisayon that Hashem gives even the greatest people is that he hides from you who you are. He gives you the ability to be absolutely unlimited. Completely unlimited. Then what does he do? He puts you in a situation where all you can see is limitations. And you can't see any of your power. And it all looks depressing. That's the ordeal. That's the ordeal. The challenge is not to do what looks possible. What looks possible is not a challenge. The challenge is to not even register what looks possible. You have to go into last night's discussion in more detail to try and understand examples of how a Jew has to approach. And many, many examples from Chazal, from Gemara, from Chumash, Tanakh, of people who didn't even begin to calculate the possible. As soon as you start to look at the possible, you're finished. As soon as you start to look at whether this thing's viable or can be done. So then you're judging yourself in terms of the natural rules. You never become supernatural. If you want to be supernatural, if you want a child to achieve greatness, they must be taught that they can do it. They mustn't have words like can't. There's no such thing as can't and I'm not capable. There's no such thing. Ain dovet omer mishum haratzon, and nothing stands in the way of desire. Nothing. Nothing. You have to discuss, you have to go through that discussion if you want to see it in more detail to work out that issue, but that's what a child needs. So again, what does a child need to know? Like this. They need to know that they can become great without any limitations. That they can be great in consideration and in concern. Great in self-control, that they can have total, absolute control over their personalities. That they can have an outpouring of kindliness and love and affection and sensitivity and gentleness that's completely unlimited. That they can become cosmic in their greatness in those areas. That's what they need to know, that they can achieve shleimus, perfection. That they can be sensitive to their own personalities to find out what it is that they have to be doing in life. Those are the basic things, the kaling that they need of self-worth and an ability to not accept limitations. What they need to be learning is consideration. How do you do it? How do you do it? Finally, one of the most beautiful ways to express it is how you give this over, whether you're a parent, whether you're a teacher, the rules are always the same. I mean, it's much, much detail to be discussed, but the framework of your giving over, you can divide it, again, I don't want to keep you late, I know people have to go. You have to divide your own giving into two categories. The kalim that you need, the tools that you need to give over, and then what it is you're giving over. Let's just briefly mention the tools. The tools that you need as a teacher, especially as a teacher in school, as a parent at home, teacher at school also applies. What you need is consideration and concern. That's what you need. You need self-discipline and discipline, and you need an outpouring of love. Again. What a parent needs to give to a child, the goal that a parent has to give, what you are aiming to give your child, is a completely unlimited outpouring of your love. Yes, that's what you have to give. How do you do it? By a very rigid system of discipline. That's how you do it. You follow? You don't give discipline for its own sake. That's what they always say, the left hand pushes away and the right hand pulls towards. You don't give discipline for discipline's sake. Then the child just learns harshness and cruelty and selfishness. You give discipline only because that's the only way the love can be found. The Calvinists always say, if you give love without limitation, it's a flood. Rain, water, which causes things to grow. If it comes unlimited, it floods the world and it destroys the world. The only way that rain's a blessing, if it's given exactly in the right amount. Discipline means that you shut off the love. Yes, you don't give a child whatever they want. You limit what it is that you give in order that the giving can be its ultimate and absolute. Now, the way you give the absolute unlimited love to a child is by measuring exactly how much you don't give, how much you discipline, so that the maximum, it's that incredible balance between, yes, between how much you limit it so that the maximum love can come across. Any more limitation, you're shrinking the love. Any more love that you give, you're spoiling them with a overflow, yes, that doesn't have structure. It's a very, very, very difficult balance. Incredibly difficult. I think there's a book called The Delicate Balance, which is a part of a series of books of raising children to care and building relationships that you can read. I think it's by Radcliffe. Torah-oriented book about how you achieve this amazing balance. How do you do it? Very briefly. First of all, actually, first is the discipline, but let's just not get confused. Since in ideology, the first is the love, you give a completely unconditional outpouring of love to your child, no matter how much control it means on you. That's the rule for all relationships. All in marriage, for example. In marriage. How do you do marriage? You do chesed on the other one and gvura on yourself. That's marriage. Yes, we reverse it. We do lots of discipline and criticism on the other person and tremendous indulgence of ourselves. That's not what marriage is. Marriage is only discipline on yourself and complete indulgence of that. So what you do is, you control yourself. You like to shout at the child because you're angry because the child's making a noise. That's not education. That's just teaching anger. Is if you shout at the child because they're making a noise when you need quiet, you're not teaching discipline to the child. You're teaching anger. You must shout at the child for being noisy because the child needs to learn how to be quiet. Not because you need... You follow? There's a massive difference. Again, if you're being disturbed by the child and you scream at the child, the child does not learn consideration. The child learns how you how to lose control. The child learns selfishness on your part and how you lose control. That's not the way you do it. First, you gain control, you calm down, you turn around and smile to make sure you're in control before you show an angry face. Once you're totally in control, you can smile, you count to 10 patiently, then you turn back and put an angry face on and you discipline the child. The child then learns discipline. They learn what they need to learn, not what you have a massive difference. And you apply discipline to a child and you don't break the rules. The rules are the most encouraging, the thing that children need most in this context is the sense, the security of a system of rules. Once a child has a sense that the rules are there, there's a structure. Beyond this, they cannot go. Beyond this, with you. If you say no, it's no. Then you, first of all, you'll be able to educate. Because if you don't have rules, you can't educate. Because you have such a competition and such a screaming match. A bedtime. Just a simple issue like bedtime, if you don't have rules, can be so traumatic and it can ruin your whole evening, your whole night. Yes, it can make you, I mean, it can make a disaster out of a family. Just bedtime. Eating. Meals. One thing like meals, like bedtime, like and most families have most of it. Yeah, if not all of them, put together. But if the rules are rigid, children accept the rules. The beauty of children is that they're not mature enough yet to question the rules. So if you make a rule, you tell a child says, why can't I do this? You say, it's a rule in this house. That's a rule, it's a rule in the house. Okay, then child, they'll test you to the limit of the rules, there's no question. Emerson Altuski tells a story of a friend of hers. Do you mind another few minutes? Emerson Altuski tells a wonderful story of a friend of hers who was teaching in a school in Israel for damaged, problem children, very disturbed children. Okay? Very, very psychologically disturbed problem children. So one day she was in the classroom, and on the third floor, one of the children, one of the little boys, was trying to jump out the window. He wanted to kill himself. So he climbed into the window, and this little boy was about to jump out in front of the class. And the teacher, as she tried to step towards him, if she would have taken a step towards him, he would have jumped out. So what was she going to say? The child was about to. So she suddenly shouted to the child, you can't do that. You need a petek from the Menahel. You need a note from the headmaster. You can't do that. Child climbed down, he had a note from the headmaster. You understand? Isn't amazing? What beautiful presence of mind. Isn't that beautiful? The child thought he could jump out the window. He had a note from the prince. Never note, he forgot his note. Climbed down. Understand? Children talking about creatures who function within it. If you set up the rules, if you set up the structure, you set up the discipline in such a way that you unbending about it in the child, but the child has to know that it's out of love. I mentioned before, and I'll tell you again, as Simcha Wasserman told me, I mean, you've got to understand, you know, we are so pathetically low in this, we can't even begin even to relate to such a story, but I'll tell you anyway, never mind, do it. And you shouldn't try and do it, it's not relevant to us. He once told me that when he was, they had a rule, listen to this, the great Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, that was his father. I mean, you have a father like that and a mother like that, so you grow up that way, to be a leader of the generation. He and her are a man in his 90s now, he just doesn't stop. I mean, you see him coming out in a few months' time, you'd be able to. How to meet him yourself, it's a shame. To be a healthy, strong. The thing is that they had a rule in their house, listen to this. They had a rule, listen to this. They had a rule in their house that if a child ever asked for something, he didn't get it. You hear that? Discipline. If a child, no matter what age, if a child asked for anything, they didn't get it. It was a rule. If you ask, you don't get.
Why?
I asked him, why did you do that? Why did your parents do that? Isn't that extreme? He said to me in a very gentle voice, he said, you know, we didn't have anything. So we wanted the children, they wanted the children to know that there just isn't. If there is, you'll be given. It's no use asking. If we have, we'll give you. But I think, he didn't tell me this, but I'm convinced that it was done to teach a principle. It was done to teach a principle. It was done to teach. So listen to this. Listen to this. His mother came home one day with a little honey. And his brother David, the only one who wasn't killed by the Germans, was 4 years old. 4 years old! And his mother walked in with her. Now, they never saw sweets. They never saw anything like that. His father only had one pair of shoes. I mean, they didn't have cheese ever, I don't think. When the yeshiva didn't have food, they didn't have food. They were completely... Honey was the most amazing delicacy. And this little boy would have given anything for a taste of that honey. But at age 4, he knew that if he asked for it, he wouldn't get. So what did he do? He pulled a chair... Listen to this boy. He pulled a chair up to the table. He sat down and he made a loud brocha she'akol. The blessing that you make on... most kinds of food, including honey, right? Brilliant! Because now, he wasn't asking, and his mother, you know, used Hashem's name already, made the brocha, you know, you gotta say. His mother went to the kitchen and brought him a glass of water. I doubt if any of you would have found it in her heart not to be manipulated in that way. That, you know, that they grew up to be the kind of people they grew up to be. The home has to be run in that fashion, and the teacher has to run the classroom in that fashion. What's needed is a sense of discipline, a sense of self-discipline. What rules do is they give a child a sense of obeying the rules. They'll be able to obey mitzvahs that way, they'll be able to discipline themselves, they'll be able to limit their own vested interests, their own tavas, their own lower self, in terms in the face of somebody else's need. That's what they need. And they need to see that the motivation behind the whole thing is not just the structure, it's not just discipline. The motivation behind the whole thing is a tremendous unconditional outpouring of love. That's what it is you're supposed to be doing. Arithmetic and spelling and pale into insignificance. They're just tools, they're just opportunities to apply who it is that you are as a personality. I just want to see if I forgot anything that I wanted to tell you. The one thing we didn't go into was the question of a child's individuality, which I said we can't discuss now. This evening in Mr. Sherman Center, we'll try to talk about the helping a child discover their own unique talents as opposed to the sort of even, you know, blend into a talent that they're taught to be, you know, in school, where everybody else is trying to do the same thing and they feel they have to do the same thing better. We'll try, Mr. Sherman, to talk about helping a child develop those unique things that make him special.